We are joined with David Rowling here from K-State Extension's Wildcat District. Good morning, David. How's it going?
Good morning. I'm doing good. Thanks. How are you?
Hey, not too bad. So, got through all the county fair time.
Yeah. So we just finished the very final cleanup for the Montgomery County Fair yesterday, and then the Lubbock County Fair wrapped up on Saturday was their cleanup, and then I believe Wilson County was Sunday. So we have 3 out of the 4 county fairs in the district done. The Crawford County Fair is going on this week, so if you want a chance to go check out the exhibits and see some livestock shows, you can head over there. And then, of course, the Interstate Fair is coming up here in Coffeyville in a couple weeks.
So is there anything that you have to help out with the Crawford County Fair over there?
No. So occasionally I'll just go over and watch some livestock shows, be around if they need help with anything, but I don't have any responsibilities over there. But I was just kind of thinking about, the week, county fairs, just kind of recapping it all. And I did just want to give a quick shout out to all the fair boards across our district. So I know us as agents, a lot of times we talk about all the work we do at county fairs and the long hours, but it really would not be possible at all without our fair boards. And our fair boards are 100% volunteers. So they're parents who have kids that are in the program, or we also have a lot of fair board members who kids have already aged out, but they're still sticking around and helping out, taking time off work to make the fairs possible. And they do a ton of work behind the scenes, so just very thankful for all of our fair boards and volunteers.
Absolutely, and it definitely has been some good fairs here in the area. Of course, we're gearing up for the Interstate Fair and Rodeo. So today I know we're going to talk a little bit about sheep and goats here, but first, before we get into that topic, I did want to ask you a question. I know that when it being so hot, I feel like I've seen a lot of people saying that there's a lot of snakes around this time of year. Is that something where, I know they're kind of cold-blooded. Is that, like the hotter it gets, the more active they get, or is there a plateau where they even get too hot?
That is a great question. I don't know the specifics of it off the top of my head, mainly because I'm not a huge fan of snakes personally.
So you're supposed to know.
I know. It's just, they're not my favorite. So I probably haven't spent as much time learning about them as I should. So I don't know the specifics about if there's a period, when it gets too hot, they kind of taper off. But like you mentioned, they're cold-blooded animals. So as the temperature increases, they do stay more active and we're more likely to see them out and about. It's also why you notice them out on asphalt roads, soaking up that heat and sunshine.
Sure. But something to be watching for here as, I know some of the fairs, people were sharing some pretty frightening pictures of snakes that they had seen.
So. Yeah, thankfully, I haven't seen that many this year. But even though, they're not my favorite, if people do have questions about what kind of snake they've seen in their yard, if it's venomous or a non-venomous one, they can submit pictures to me at the extension office and I can help get those identified. We just do ask that you only bring pictures to the office. We have had some incidences in the past where folks have brought in live snakes to the office. One of those happened when I first started as an agent, and it was in a 1 gallon pickle jar. Thankfully, it was a non-venomous snake because there was no lid or top or anything covering the jar. So we are happy to help ID snakes, but please just bring or send us pictures. No live examples.
All right, very good. Well, shifting gears a little bit, I know that I want to talk a few topics on sheep and goats here.
Yeah, so we're just, in the middle of fair season, wrapping up some county fairs, getting ready for interstate fair coming up. So for breeders that breed for lambs and kids to sell mainly to 4-H and FFA members, they're already in the middle of their breeding season plans, because ideally, for those kids and lambs to be the right age for 4-H'ers to show at fair, they are going to be hitting the ground end of December into January. And goats and sheep have a 5-month gestation period. So, you know, they already have put their bucks and rams in, or they're getting ready to. So they're kind of already in the thick of breeding season plans. But I know for a lot of goat and sheep breeders more on the commercial end, typically those kids and lambs won't be hitting the ground until springtime. So fall is kind of the traditional breeding season for sheep and goats, which makes now a great time while you're making those breeding plans to also be checking your herd and making sure everyone is in good condition to make your breeding season as successful as possible. So that includes checking the body condition scores of everyone. So the body condition score is the amount of fat cover a goat or sheep has. And the easiest place to check it is across their loin, between their ribs and their hips. So you're just feeling for the amount of fat cover. And the body condition scoring system goes from 1 to 5. So 1 is really, really skinny, like just skin and bones. And then 5 is they are definitely over conditioned. They're on the fat side. So you won't really even be able to feel their backbone when you check their fat cover. So going into breeding season, the ideal body condition is around a 3 to about a 3.5. So right there between a 3 and a 4, especially for our bucks and our rams, because they're going to be spending a lot of extra energy during breeding season. So if they go into breeding season about a 3.5, a little bit closer to that 4, that puts them set up pretty good for losing some weight during breeding season and still finishing up breeding season and not being on the skinny side. The other thing that's really important as we prepare for breeding season, and just generally speaking in goat and sheep management this time of year, is to be checking their Fomantia score, so checking that inner eyelid color. I've heard from quite a few sheep and goat owners that are having problems with barber pole worms, which is always one of the most troubling parasites for sheep and goats, and they're a blood-sucking parasite. So checking the inner eyelid color, if the inner eyelid color is a pale pink to white color, that means that those animals need to be treated for internal parasites, specifically the barber pole worm. And another great option is to work with your vet and take a fecal sample. If you have an animal that is, you know, underweight, really showing signs of struggling with parasites, because that will help you identify specifically which internal parasites they have the heaviest load, so you can really target those parasites with the correct dewormer, and then especially dosing that dewormer correctly.
Very good. We're talking with David Rowling here from K-State Extension a little bit about getting those sheep and goats ready for that breeding season. Is there really, you know, a lot of times we do kind of lump them together. Is there anything specific between sheep and goats that we need to keep an eye on, or mostly pretty much the same treatment?
Generally, it's mostly the same treatment. The one thing that gets really specific kind of between sheep and goats is when it comes to managing their minerals. So talking about breeding season, and then also when we kind of jump ahead to kidding and lambing season, two minerals that play a big role is copper and selenium. selenium. If animals are really deficient in that, if the mothers are, those kids and lambs in severe cases can have white muscle disease when they're born, which can cause them not to survive for very long. So you also want to make sure your sheep and goats are on a good, like, loose mineral supplemental program. If you think there's signs of deficiencies, you can work with your vet to give some shots of mineral to kind of boost them up. But goats have a really high copper demand that they require, where sheep are a lot more sensitive to copper. If sheep have too much copper, especially continually over a long period of time, then it can actually end up killing them. So that is the big difference between managing your sheep and your goats. When it comes to a lot of things, like, you know, they could be running in the same pasture, you can manage them really similarly. But because of that copper requirement, that's when it becomes tricky. So it's easiest if, you know, you have your goats separate and you give them a mineral made for goats, so it meets all their requirements and has that higher copper level. But for sheep, you're going to want to use a mineral and a feed specific for sheep to make sure that you're not overdosing them on copper.
Very good. Well, anything else, David, as we wrap up this segment here today?
One other thing I wanted to mention when it comes to breeding season for sheep and goats, the most common practice for breeding for sheep and goats is what we call pen breeding. So you're just turning the buck or the ram in the pasture with the does or ewes. So usually, you know, you write the date down when the ram, for example, is turned in, and then you write the date down when that ram is pulled out of the pasture. And you just have this, like, month-long window, for example, where you could be lambing. And if you want to get a little bit more specific lambing or kidding dates, you can put what's called a marking harness on your ram or your buck, or they also have marking paint. So what that is if you kind of think of a harness for a dog, so it's a similar design, but in the middle on their bottom, it crosses across their chest and it holds a crayon there. So when they breed the ewes or the does, it leaves a colored mark on that ewe or doe's rump. So that is a great way of being able to identify when does and ewes were bred, so then you can have more exact kidding dates for them. And then if you change that color about every 19 days, then you can also see if a doe was bred a second time, for example. So it just helps you keep more accurate records.
Very good. So, David, if folks do want to get a hold of you and have some questions, what's the best way to do that?
They can reach me at our Altamont office. That number is 620-784-5337.
Very good. And what are we going to be talking about in our next segment?
In our next segment, we are going to be talking about controlling pond weeds.
Very good. That's all on the way here as our Green Setup program continues, brought to you by Green Acres here in Coffeyville. On the way as well, after that, we're going to be getting into our Words of Inspiration program, Farm to Fork, and then early bird edition of Open Line. At 9:10, we'll have a report from the Coffeyville Chamber of Commerce. Be back to Open Line through 11 o'clock here on the Mighty 690. Right now, we have 79 degrees as we approach 8 o'clock. News on the way here on KGGF.
Okay. We are back for our Green Upside Up program with David Rowling. We're going to talk about pond weeds today.
Yes. So this time of year, I get a lot of questions about managing pond weeds. So aquatic plants are naturally occurring in ponds, and they are an important part of the ecosystem. But kind of like all plants, they can become overabundant. And when they become overabundant, we consider them pond weeds.
Okay. So pond weeds, are they necessarily like bad, good, or?
So they're not necessarily bad, but they're not necessarily good either. So they're kind of in the middle. They're really a nuisance when it comes to enjoying your pond. So if you like swimming in your pond, fishing especially is when I hear a lot of complaints about them, because if you have an overabundance of pond weeds and you're trying to fish, you know, your fishing line gets tangled in them. You end up catching weeds instead of fish, and it can just get really frustrating. So the important part when it comes to controlling pond weeds is to correctly identify them, so we can use the control method that is most effective on that type of plant. So just like when it comes to weeds in your lawn or your pasture, there are several different types of pond weeds. So we have what we consider floating plants in ponds, which when you think of lily pads or green algae, I get a lot of phone calls about those are considered floating. But we also have emergent and submerged classes of aquatic plants. And those are plants that have more of a root system. So the emergent plants, they have a root system underneath the water surface, but then you'll see like leaves, for example, floating on the top of a pond. And the submergent plants are mainly underwater, so you really won't start to notice them in your pond until there becomes an overabundance of them. So the control method will depend on the type of plant that we are dealing with. So there are mechanical control options is what we call them, and that is using tools that are made specifically for pond management. One example is a pond rake. So think of a lawn rake. It's similar in design. The only difference is between the teeth of the rake, it has really sharp razor blades. So for our pond weeds that have a root system, you're going to extend that rake out over the pond, and then you're going to drag it back to you just like you would use a regular rake. And those teeth are going to cut the root system as you drag those plants towards the edge of a pond. So that can be a pretty labor intensive option, especially when you've reached the point where the weeds are already really overtaking the pond. So we also have some chemical control options, which are herbicides, of course. And when it comes to ponds, it's very important to use herbicides that have been labeled specific for aquatic use, because they have been approved to use in ponds. That's what they're designed for. So we don't want to use, you know, the regular Roundup, for example, that we have in our garage that we use to treat weeds in our yard. And that's really when it becomes super important to correctly identify these plants, so we can use the correct herbicide that's most effective on that particular plant, and we're not overusing herbicides or using herbicides that won't work at all for the plant that we're dealing with. And then there's also biological control options. So the most popular one that we hear a lot about, that I've gotten some questions about recently, is having grass carp in a pond to control weeds. So they are a great option. The one kind of misinformation people think about them is that they will help control green algae, or they'll help control all pond weeds. And it would be awesome if they did, but unfortunately that is not the case. So just like we have foods that are our favorite and we have other foods that, you know, we don't like, maybe don't eat, grass carp are the same way. So any type of aquatic plant that has a root system, they will be very helpful in controlling those. However, they unfortunately will not help you when it comes to controlling green algae on your pond, for example. Another control option, or more of a preventive measure, I should say, for pond weeds is if, you know, we're just starting out at the beginning of summer, there's also aquatic dyes that you can add to your pond. And this is just going to limit the amount of sunlight that goes through the water's surface. And this in turn will help limit the amount of growth of especially green algae, for example, in a pond, because pond weeds really thrive on hot, sunny weather. So the weather we've had these last couple weeks, those aquatic plants, they're just going to be loving it. So I've been getting more calls about pond weeds lately because of that.
What are some of the weeds that grow around ponds?
Yeah, so green algae, which isn't exactly a weed, but it is a really common one I get questions about. So when you have something mossy looking, it's a darker, more kind of olive green color floating on the top of your pond. Typically, that's green algae. Not always, but most of the time. Another common one is actually, its name is American pond weed. So not a super specific or scientific name, but it is a common one I see. And it has more of a root system. It will look kind of viney on the top and then have kind of oval shaped leaves on it. Another common one I see is coontail, and it will be right below the water's surface typically. From a distance, sometimes it can look like green algae because if there's a lot of it, it will kind of float together and mat up. But if you pull a sample of it out of the water, it is a plant that is connected, and it looks kind of like a bottle brush. So it just has different little green spines, kind of brushy looking. It's always a common one. And then we also have
which one has, like, not like people call it like the corn dog, you know what I'm talking about, like the
So that is cattails.
That's
what, yeah, so cattails, they are along the banks of the pond. And they can actually, especially if you have them just starting around a pond, they can actually be dug out. It can be pretty labor intensive. You want to make sure you get the whole root system of the plant to prevent them growing. But they're one kind of like lily pads. If there's not a lot of them, they can kind of be pretty around the pond. And a lot of people like to have them around the pond. So they're a great example of how aquatic plants can add good habitat to a pond. They can kind of be picturesque around a pond, but then when they become overabundant, they could be a little bit of a problem if you're trying to get into your pond to go fishing, for example.
Yes. Now, I remember growing up, I mean, my brothers, you know, every time it's like, you should try it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, they're kind of a fun one to look at.
Well, David, do you have anything else that you would like to talk about in terms of the pond weeds or anything coming up for the Wildcat Extension?
The only other thing I wanted to mention in relation to pond weeds, so this hot, sunny weather we've been having is the perfect environment for pond weeds to take off and grow. I also had my first question about blue-green algae on a pond the end of last week. So that is something for people to be aware of when they're out checking their livestock. Also, make sure you take a good look at your pond. So blue-green algae, as the name suggests, it's really bright green in color, sometimes a bluish green. And it's going to look like paint has spilled across the water's surface. It has a smoother appearance than the typical green algae. And the blue-green algae is the one we really want to watch out for because it's actually a type of bacteria. And when it dies off, that bacteria releases toxins that can be very harmful, even deadly to animals. So when you notice that on your pond, if possible, you want to prevent animals from drinking out of that pond right away, and then take a water sample and send it off to the K-State Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. They can test it for toxins to determine if it is harmful to animals or not. And I've talked to people in the past that have said, oh, you know, I think we had that on our pond, but we treated the pond for it, so it's fine now. So it's great that you saw it, you took the steps to treat it. But just an important reminder that when you treat a pond for blue-green algae, that algae goes away by dying off. So that's when it's going to release the toxins. So that is a very important time to make sure animals aren't drinking from that pond, because that's when it's most likely to have those toxins in the water, and they affect animals super fast. So a lot of times that animal goes down and there's not enough time to get a vet out to treat them and save that animal.
How can you prevent like blue-green algae? Is there really any way you can prevent it?
It is a harder one to prevent. So one way is that if you have a pond that has reoccurring problems with blue-green algae, we can work with Joe Gerken, our state specialist that deals with aquaculture and ponds, and run some water tests to see if there's a nutrient imbalance in that pond that is causing problems with it. Having those aquatic dyes added to the pond will help reduce occurrences of any type of algae because it limits the sunlight. For smaller ponds, you can look into adding an aerator. So that's going to like move that water around. Water movement also helps decrease the chance. And then keeping a good grass buffer on the banks around your pond. The grass helps act as a filter. So any excess nutrients, for example, if you fertilized your pasture and then it rained right after that fertilizer was applied, some of those nutrients can wash into the pond, and those extra nutrients can help contribute to those blue-green algae problems.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to talk about, David?
That covers all the topics I wanted to cover for today. I do have one class that I wanted to mention that is coming up tomorrow in Independence. Our intern Esther is going to be hosting a bracelet workshop tomorrow in Independence from 9 to 10 a.m. for ages 8 to 15. And there is no need to bring your own supplies. Supplies will be provided unless you just have, you know, some really cool beads that you want to use. So you can sign up for that workshop by calling our Independence office at 620-339-2690.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Adavin, for coming out today. And that is our Green Side Up program for today. And thank you.
Thanks for having me.